From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield's away. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the Democratic National Convention acted to distinguish its tone from the doom and gloom of last week's RNC. In her historic speech Thursday night, Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton pushed back against the idea that America is a country on the brink of chaos, suggesting instead that it is
a country where all our children can dream and those dreams are within reach, where families are strong, communities are safe, and yes, where love trumps hate.
Despite images of harmony at the closing gavel, the press informed us throughout the week that all was not well in Philadelphia. There was an unruly element that threatened to burn right through the love.
Drama with a capital D.
Capital D.
Sanders supporters booing every mention of Clinton's name.
People are booing. People are chanting Hillary.
Late night comics seemed fixed on the tears of the thwarted opposition. Fixed, but unmoved.
There were so many white women crying, I thought Pinterest had died.
I have not seen that many crying women since Bernie opened for the Beatles.
But as the comics and the pundits analyzed the agony and acrimony of the Bernie battalion, the speakers at the podium were focused on a more existent threat.
The richest thing about Donald Trump is his hypocrisy.
Hand over your money, your jobs, your children's future, and the great Trump hot air machine will reveal all the answers.
He's trying to tell us he cares about the middle class. Give me a break. That's a bunch of malarkey.
Amid the shellacking, a deadly serious accusation that Donald Trump may not be loyal to the nation he aims to lead, former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta.
He asked the Russians to engage in hacking or intelligence efforts against the United States of America to affect an election.
It was a thread that the press had been tugging at all week, set off by a leak of DNC emails, most likely executed by Russian hackers, released by WikiLeaks in an effort, some say, to tip the presidency to Donald Trump.
To get an idea of what a Trump presidency might look like, look to Putin's Russia with its hyper-nationalism, saber-rattling, and macho talk.
But in the latest New York Review of Books, journalist Masha Gessen, author of The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, says Trump is not Putin's puppet, though he is clearly a gift. Masha, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
At the start of your piece, you cite stories from the Washington Post, Slate, Talking Points memo that all link Trump's campaign and business ventures to Putin. In the Washington Post, first Josh Rogan, later Ann Applebaum, noted that Trump's people were apparently indifferent to what was in the GOP party platform, except for one point when they blocked an amendment that would pledge weapons to Ukraine.
My argument is that it's there, but it's not very big. Carter Page, who's the foreign policy advisor to Trump, who does have business interests in Russia, that's documented. He was in Russia a week before the Republican convention. As soon as he got to Moscow, the Kremlin leaked the information that he was in Moscow, very much trying to spin the story that he was there for consultations with the Kremlin. Then they sent reporters to Page's appearance at an economics university, and the reporter asked him, will you advise Trump to lift economic sanctions against Russia? He answered in Russian by quoting Putin to the effect that countries should not meddle in each other's business. So suggesting that Carter Page is a friendly presence to Russia in the Trump campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Then the amendment that would support lethal aid to Ukraine doesn't pass. It's blocked by the Trump campaign. But the plank promising to maintain and, if necessary, increase sanctions on Russia stays. That remained. Mm-hmm. That's in the platform. So I think what we're seeing is somebody in the campaign, namely Carter Page, who wants to give his friends in Russia what he can, and it's not very much.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about Josh Marshall's point in Talking Points memo? He says that Trump's most conspicuous foreign policy statements track with the positions that Putin cares the most about. Trump's suggestion that the U.S. and thus NATO might not come to the defense of NATO member states in the Baltics unless they paid up.
This is where we really cross over to conspiratorial thinking, because what Trump said was perfectly consistent with everything else he has said and everything else he has done in his life. This is a man who doesn't pay his debts. This is a man who doesn't honor his partnerships. He approaches politics in exactly the same way that he approaches business. And so he says, you know, why should we honor our obligations? To see traces of Putin there, that's conspiratorial.
It's good for Putin, but that doesn't mean Putin had a hand in it.
Exactly.
You think the media have totally missed the point, and you use a great metaphor to illustrate this. You wrote, imagine that your teenage child has built a bomb and has just set it off in your house. The house is falling down all around you, and you're blaming the neighbor's kid who threw a pebble at your window. So Trump's the kid with the matches and Putin's the kid with the pebble?
Yes. And the thing is, you know, your kid is still in the basement and he's building something even bigger. Whereas the neighbor's kid, he just runs around the neighborhood throwing pebbles in everybody's window. I mean, we know he does that. It's fascinating to me, sort of the psychology of this desire to other the threat. It's a very American thing to do. Somehow it becomes a little bit easier mentally to live with if it's other people.
So you think that's why the Putin-Trump connection is such an attractive narrative for the media?
I think so. It communicates things that sound credible. I mean, I also think that we in the media have a very difficult time using big, scary words for good reason. When the time has come to use the word fascist, to use the word homegrown fascist, which is actually the only kind that there is, we have a really hard time doing that. So this is a different way of communicating how terrifying we're finding Trump. But it's a bad way. It prevents us from seeing just how dire a threat Trump is. In the middle of the 20th century, there was a whole cadre of great European exiled thinkers, Eric Fromm, Herbert Marcuse, and Theodor Adorno. And I think the fact that they were exiles was very important because their imaginations were trained by what they had seen in Mussolini's Italy and in Hitler's Germany, that modern industrialized societies create the conditions for the rise of fascism. And at any time, a charismatic demagogue can come and use those conditions to rise to the top. And that is an existential threat to any democracy and to any society.
You say that this emphasis on Putin as a big influence on Trump derives from a lack of imagination.
Yes, absolutely. Let's say David Cameron, who, when he called for a referendum on whether Great Britain should secede from the European Union, he clearly did so because he could not entertain for one second the possibility that the Leave voters would win. And his failure of imagination led to a referendum that didn't have to happen. When we believe the unlikely and ignore the obvious, it is often a function of the failure of imagination. And I think that's also what's happening with Trump.
I don't know. To me, it sounds a lot more like denial.
Well, I think denial is another word for a failure of imagination.
You got to work strenuously to keep up a healthy denial.
Oh, I see what you mean. So I'm saying you're not doing enough, and you're saying, oh, you're working really hard.
You wrote that we don't want to see Trump as a, quote, thoroughly American creation. So what would it mean to embrace Trump as a thoroughly American creation?
We need to start imagining what happens if he becomes president. Now, the American system doesn't actually give the chief executive a lot of power inside the country. There's an intricate system of checks and balances that will force him to mobilize things through rhetoric. And that basically means, I think, that we have to start imagining witch hunts. We have to start imagining kind of wars at home. We have to start imagining what kind of groups he's going to start blaming for all his problems and all our problems, whether real or imaginary. And those can be groups that exist now, groups he's mentioned, like Muslims, and groups that aren't even constituted as groups at the moment, like people who studied foreign language in college.
So your advice to the news consumer?
My advice to the news consumer is imagine the worst.
Well, thanks a lot, Masha.
Yes, next time you want to have an uplifting conversation, call me.
Journalist Masha Gessen is the author, most recently, of a book about the Boston Marathon bombers called The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. Her piece in the New York Review of Books is called The Trump-Putin Fallacy. Coming up, the top migrant myths revealed. This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The recent wave of migrants has sparked fear across Europe. A recent Pew survey of 10 nations finds that half of those polled believe refugees increase the likelihood of terrorism and gobble up jobs and social benefits. In fact, Greeks, Poles, Indians, Hungarians, and the French say a loss of jobs and social benefits to incoming refugees is their greatest worry. But should it be? The truth is, Europe's population is aging fast. One UN report estimated that Germany alone needs more than 300,000 migrants a year just to maintain its population. And even then, the ratio of working-age people to the elderly would fall. But there is fear, huge fear, and there are a ton of myths. One of which is that the movement of large numbers of people is breaking news. Actually, it's constant. But it plays as breaking news. So to help you cope, we offer yet another Breaking News Consumer's Handbook, Migration Edition. Heaven Crawley is chair in international migration at Coventry University. She's found that stories about migrants invariably are framed in one of two ways. The first, not surprisingly, is as a threat.
A threat to security through the frame of terrorism or crime, a threat to economic assets, in particular employment, to social housing and health, but also a sort of cultural threat, if you like, what it means to be British, often not defined or fairly ill-defined.
And then you've got the counter-narrative, and that's the victim frame.
Yeah, I mean, the victim frame is less prevalent than the villain frame.
Three-quarters of the stories fell roughly into the villain frame, and the last quarter in the victim one.
We're talking about the beginning of 2015, culminated in a way with the story of Aylan Kurdi, the small Syrian child who was washed up on a Turkish beach. Mm-hmm. So what we saw was the reporting of deaths in the Mediterranean Sea, of boats that had sunk, but also of individuals who'd had very traumatic or difficult journeys. But if this kind of story of the refugee as victim is one that's dominated by their needs and the fact that they are lacking, then it again loses sight of the fact that many of them have come from very skilled backgrounds. They may be engineers, they may be doctors, they've got all sorts of capabilities in terms of contributing economically and socially. That's lost in this very singular narrative of the victim.
One thing that's bothered us is that stories of immigration tend to be reported as breaking news. And we know that this is an ongoing and context-rich situation. You know, back in 2014, we saw heaps of headlines about children pouring over the border, and there's no way that came out of nowhere.
No. Migration is a feature of our society for, well, I've been working in this area for 25 years, but of course, actually, much, much longer. What's interesting about the current time is the way in which these stories about migration are so tightly tied to numbers, as if numbers were all that mattered.
I mean, if you've got 1,000 and then suddenly it's 100,000, I mean, that has implications.
Sure, but I can tell you that even economic migrants are much, much larger in number than refugees. But because they travel legally and because they don't get washed up on beaches, they don't hit the headlines. It's not about the numbers. It's about the nature of the movement. And for refugees in particular, there is no way to legally enter a country. There is no way of claiming asylum until you get to that place. And it's that illegal form of movement that's really capturing the public's attention.
Could you talk to me about the lexicon of reporting these stories, particular words that news consumers should regard as red flags?
We see words like flood and swarm. Even our ex-Prime Minister David Cameron used the word swarm to discuss a few hundred refugees and migrants who were trying to find a way out of France to the UK. So this word swarm or flood gives the impression of something that's much larger than the reality.
And what about pictures?
Well, the images are highly gendered, but they're also highly racialized, particularly in the context of boat movements from, for example, Libya to Italy. We see large numbers of young, black, African, usually men. The flows are actually much more complicated than that. There are probably 20, even more now, percent of children, and there are also similar sorts of numbers of women. But those images are very much framed as young single men because they are feeding into the villain frame, essentially, as a potential threat. Of course, there are people who are arriving in that way, but you lose the individual stories of those people and what their contribution and their capability potentially is. The other image, and we saw it very much in relation to the Eastern Mediterranean route from Turkey to Greece, is, of course, the image of the victim. The body washing up on the shore, women, children huddled in the cold and the damp. It's a very particular image. And again, it is not the whole picture of that particular flow.
The frame that's used least, and the one that I assume you would most prefer, is the contributor frame. That is that people can come in and really make a contribution to the nation that they land in. But even this frame, you see two principal problems with.
One is that it tends to be very abstract. It tends to be framed in terms of, for example, GDP, which for most people doesn't really mean anything to them when they're thinking about what's going on in their immediate neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And the other is that when the media does talk about the potential contribution of migrants, what's interesting, and including in our piece of research looking at the media representation of these issues, is that they no longer get defined as a migrant. They just become an entrepreneur, a business person. Their identity as a migrant almost sort of slips away. It becomes a non-issue. The point is that it really demonstrates the strength of the victim or villain frame. If the migrant isn't a victim or a villain, then we don't know what to do with them.
Heaven, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Heaven Crawley is chair in international migration at Coventry University. Back on these shores, the view towards immigrants varied wildly in emphasis and tone. This week in Philadelphia, people with accents were seen and heard in a blaze of welcome empathy.
Donald Trump, have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy.
The week before in Cleveland, not so much.
Nearly 180,000 illegal immigrants with criminal records, ordered deported from our country, are tonight roaming free to threaten peaceful citizens.
Myth and reality matter when they create policy. So we turn now to the great and enduring American myths about illegal immigration. Doug Massey is a professor of sociology at Princeton, specializing in immigration. What's the biggest myth?
The biggest myth today is that it's still continuing. In fact, illegal migration ended 8 years ago and has been zero or negative since 2008. Because migration is a young person's game. If you don't migrate between the ages of 15 and 30, you don't migrate at all. And the average age in Mexico is now 28 years old.
Another popular myth is that undocumented immigrants commit a lot of crimes. Do they?
Immigrants in general, and immigrant neighborhoods in particular, have very low rates of crime, much lower than native-born people. The U.S. counties along the Mexico-U.S. border are among the safest, most crime-free counties in the United States. And as far as terrorist threat goes, there's no evidence that there's ever been a terrorist cell, any terrorist that's ever tried to cross into the United States from Mexico.
What about the fact that immigrants steal our jobs? Is that a fact?
Not really. the one group that they compete with in the labor force are low-skilled, high school or less educated workers. And even in that group, the effects are actually quite small. Immigrants actually maintain jobs in the United States that would have gone overseas a long time ago. You're just not going to get Native American workers to go out into the Coachella Valley in 120-degree heat to harvest watermelons. Mexicans and Latinos more broadly are the backbone of the agriculture workforce and also the food processing workforce. All the studies show that on balance, they're quite a benefit to the United States. They pay taxes. They're also consumers and create demand, and they provide a variety of services to make Americans more productive, particularly in the fields of childcare, yard work, health care. I think if people really thought about it, what they would want to do would be to legalize the 11 million people so their wage rates would rise and they wouldn't compete unfairly with American workers. At this point, these people have been here on an average of 10 to 20 years because there hasn't been any new migration for the last 8 years. And the majority of these people now have U.S.-born American citizen kids. So by punishing the parents, you're also punishing the kids.
People will say, well, the undocumented immigrant population is a big drain on health and social services, school resources, the welfare system. This is something that we heard quite a lot at the Republican National Convention.
It's not a big drain. Immigrants in general are very uninvolved in the welfare system. In fact, legal immigrants are banned for 5 years from receiving these federally subsidized services. Undocumented migrants are banned from Obamacare, of course, the Affordable Care Act. The only real expense is emergency medical care. Schools and health care are the two places where they do have an effect because they're young and they have kids. Kids that are born here are American citizen kids. It does create a burden for localities that have large immigrant populations. That could be solved with a revenue sharing formula that took into account the number of foreign born in different states and localities. But it's much easier for politicians to whine about the burdens rather than actually take care of the burdens using federal revenues. So medical care and schools are the two biggest.
Actually, there's a bigger one that you've talked about quite a lot. The cost associated with illegal immigration?
Well, the immigration detention system is now the fastest growing portion of the American criminal justice complex. For decades, people would come, they work for a period, and go back. What we did starting in the mid-1980s was to ramp up border enforcement, really militarize the border between Mexico and the United States. And this drove up the costs and the risks of border crossing to a point where people decided they weren't going to cross the border anymore. And they did this by staying put in the United States once they'd made it in, rather than circulating back and forth as they had been. So essentially in the 1990s, we were spending $3 to $4 billion a year, and we doubled the net rate of undocumented population growth.
So let us go back even further to the 1965 U.S. Immigration Act that unintentionally created this flood of undocumented immigration in the first place. Because, as you've written, prior to the mid-60s, illegal immigration from Mexico really didn't happen because the U.S. was legally admitting about 50,000 Mexicans a year. So what happened in 1965?
Two things happened in 1965. First, Congress amended the Immigration and Nationality Act. And they did it for good reason. They wanted to get rid of the racist provisions that had been put in place in the 19th century and the early 20th century, policies that discriminated against Asians and Africans and Southern and Eastern Europeans. They scrapped the old system and tried to replace it with a neutral system that didn't favor any particular country. And they did this by creating a new system where every country got 20,000 visas per year. The quota for legal immigration from Mexico is the same as the quota for Botswana or Nepal. And of course, Mexico's 130 million people. It's our second largest trading partner. We share a 2,000-mile border, and it's treated like some of the most distant nations in the world.
You say this led essentially to the creation of illegal immigration as a thing.
Yeah, in the late 1950s, there was no illegal migration from Mexico. The other component of what was going on was a large guest worker program called the Bracero Program.
Pretty bad rep the Bracero Program had. A lot of those immigrants who came into this country to work in agriculture were horribly mistreated and exploited.
Yes, and that's why Congress was acting. Both their repeal of the Bracero legislation and their amendment to the Immigration and Nationality Act were not considered to be immigration law at the time. They were considered to be civil rights policies. They were righting old wrongs. And the Bracero program came to be seen as an exploitative labor program on a par with Southern sharecropping. But what followed was four decades of illegal migration and increasing growing exploitation, far worse than what Bracero migrants experienced back in the 1950s and early 60s.
So why is immigration such a political flashpoint if it's not actually a problem?
Well, I think that the United States is in the midst of a very strong and profound demographic transition that has unnerved a lot of older white Americans. You have to remember that the baby boom grew up in the whitest, most native America that's ever existed. In 1970, the foreign-born percentage of the United States for the first and only time in American history fell below 5%. And African Americans were segregated and out of sight. That's the America that people look back and think that's normal. And that's all changed. There are two things that happened to create kind of a perfect storm for an anti-immigrant, nativist, xenophobic reaction. One is a rapidly changing demography, which upsets people, especially older people. And the second thing was a massive increase in income inequality. Immigrants aren't to blame for that. That's just part of the broader set of changes that have come with a global economy. And the Mexico border has become an all-purpose symbol of a line drawn in the sand by politicians to show their concern about America and its security to voters. But it's all basically theater.
This illegal invasion idea is tied to whatever the perceived security threat of the day happens to be.
Well, immigration has always been used as a ploy in American domestic politics. And when illegal migration arose after 1965, it fit into the discourse perfectly because if migrants are illegal, by definition, they're lawbreakers and criminals. So you find even liberal politicians call for more border enforcement against whatever the perceived enemy of the day is. During the 1980s, during the Reagan administration, it was communists and Sandinistas from Central America. Then in the 90s and 2000s, it became Al-Qaeda, and now it's ISIS, and most recently it was Ebola.
Let me ask you about the coverage of immigration issues. If you are advising news consumers on red flags in coverage that people should be very wary of?
The first thing to look for is somebody trying to scare you? The second is, who are they citing? Where are they getting their information, if at all? Media coverage tends to present this side and that side, and they present them as equivalent. Look at the organizations that are producing the information. Organizations that have a self-interested stake in portraying immigration as bad, I don't think can be trusted. The Center for Immigration Studies, Numbers America, they're avowedly anti-immigrant. They take census data, but then they twist it in ways that are really misleading.
Mm-hmm. And what's an organization that does good work?
The Pew Research Center in Washington, D.C. Pew Research Center is nonpartisan. It employs highly qualified demographers and social scientists to analyze the data to provide a factual base for understanding important public policy issues. And another obvious source is the U.S. National Academy of Sciences.
What about people who want their nation back? Can they get it back with a wall or through deportations?
That cow's out of the barn. Even if we cut off the immigrants completely today, we would still undergo a gradual process by which the United States would become a majority-minority society where whites are no longer a majority.
So the people who want their country back, they can't have it.
No, but if you listen to the rhetoric in the 1920s, old line WASP leaders said, if we don't stop this immigration now, we're going to become an Italian and Polish nation. And, okay, there's lots of Italians and Polish Americans today, but nobody sees them as different, as un-American. And the same thing will happen with Latinos and Asians. It'll probably be a very different America with very different words to describe who we are as a people and what kind of social categories exist within it. But it's not going to go back to the 1970 period where it was only 4.7% immigrant and blacks were segregated, Asians were out of sight, and Latinos were a small percentage of the population. That world is gone for good and there's nothing you can do about it except adapt and make it work for you.
Doug, thank you very much.
Thanks. Good luck with the report.
Doug Massey is a professor of sociology at Princeton, specializing in immigration. Coming up, a peculiar media rule meant to protect minorities and immigrants in Germany may actually be making things worse. This is On the Media.
On the Media is brought to you by ZBiotics. Tired of wasting a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before? ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic is here to help. ZBiotics is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic, invented by scientists to feel like your normal self the morning after drinking. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol, which is responsible for rough mornings after. Go to ZBiotics.com/OTM to get 15% off your first order when you use OTM at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. That's ZBiotics.com/OTM, and use the code OTM at checkout for 15% off.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Remember the awful, wonderful summer of 2015? First, the awful. Hundreds of thousands of people forced from their homes by wars in the Middle East. Some crossed the Mediterranean in leaky boats. Some didn't make it. Once in Europe, they trudged north by foot through hostile lands, following maps posted to Facebook, until they arrived at the wonderful. When the rest of the world said, "Go away," Germany's Chancellor, Angela Merkel, said, "Yes, please come." And Germans flocked to train stations to cheer on the new arrivals. Of course, TV cameras were there, too. And within a few months, about 1 million refugees and other migrants had arrived in Germany. Population, 80 million. But the rapturous welcomes last summer were followed this summer by stories chronicling horrible acts of terror. Istanbul, Nice, Normandy, Munich. Actually, that last one wasn't a terrorist act, but you wouldn't have known that from the initial reporting.
Police spokesman Marcus de Gloria Martin said this was a terrorist attack, but who did it and why is unclear.
If it seems very likely this is another terrorist incident, then I think it proves once again that we have a global phenomenon.
It turned out that the shooter was not a refugee, and he had no links to ISIS or any terrorist network. But no matter, the narrative resonated with many Germans. Reporter Ilya Meritz went there to find out why.
If you want to see the paranoid style in German politics, go to Dresden in eastern Germany. Go to Dresden on a Monday night, because every Monday after work in the Baroque center of town, a safe space is created for all kinds of opinions that, until very recently, were considered unacceptable. It starts with a sing-along. Three middle-aged guys on guitar. One of them is playing his instrument underneath a poncho. Can't let a little rain ruin some patriotic songs, right? And as umbrellas start to go up, so do flags. Black, red, and gold German flags, white, blue, and red Russian flags. Then some weirdly menacing-looking flags I'm pretty sure don't hang in the United Nations. And signs, so many signs. No Sharia. Islam means repression. Don't turn this church into a mosque. And then, on a stage obscured by umbrellas, a mic goes on.
Hallo Dresden!
It's Siegfried Debritz, a leader of the group that calls itself Pegida. That's Patriotic Europeans Against the Islamization of the Occident. Occident as in the West.
Was Pegida verändert hat? Alles.
Now, I know for some people, when they hear an angry voice speaking German to a crowd, their mind immediately goes to Hitler. I'm not one of those people. To me, at first, Debritz's speech is funny and sophisticated. He doesn't talk about headscarves or immigrants stealing jobs. Instead, he does this 20-minute riff that's almost pure media analysis. At one point, Debritz reads out a quote in a mainstream newspaper from a former public broadcasting chief. It concerns this German compound noun that the Pegida people like to use a lot, Lügenpresse, or the lying media. And before he can finish, the crowd starts to bellow.
Lügenpresse! Lügenpresse!
And here I am, holding a mic high in the air. Hey, guys. A few minutes later, Debritz reads out this quote from Germany's finance minister, saying immigration is good for the country, and the people know what to do. Volksverräter, traitor to the people. This word chills me. I looked it up later. It turns out the Nazis introduced it as a legal term specifically for treason committed by Aryans. Stefan Niggemeier is an independent journalist who covers media. He says the views expressed at rallies like this one are far from the German mainstream. But Pegida and other anti-immigration groups have been effective at spreading a pernicious idea. The idea that the media and the political class are systematically deceiving the German people, suppressing the truth about migrants.
Clearly, there's a problem when your readership assume you won't tell them the truth and they kind of fill in the blanks. I think that's very worrying, yeah.
It's a big change from 1 year ago. When trainloads of Syrians started arriving in large numbers, journalism and public opinion seemed to be in lockstep.
There was a huge wave of support. People greeted them at the main station, at the railway stations.
Call it phase one, love.
That carried over into the media, which was also kind of happy to show these great stories about people helping people in need.
Love was followed, as it so often is, by phase two, reality check.
Stories about mayors of small towns and cities saying, actually, we are having trouble here. We don't know where to put them. We don't really have the means. And I think you started to feel, okay, it's not going to be that easy.
And phase two, reality check, might have lasted for a long time if unforeseen events hadn't triggered phase three, panic.
The big event that changed everything was New Year's Eve in Cologne.
The first night of 2016, large numbers of women were robbed, sexually assaulted, and harassed by roaming posses of young men. Over 1,000 assaults were reported to the Cologne police that night. Eyewitnesses described the perps as North African or Middle Eastern in appearance. But curiously, news of the attacks didn't come out until days later. Police and politicians didn't immediately report the attacks. And neither did the press.
It happened at the weekend. It was a holiday. So it's not really the day when journalists start digging for things. And it was only triggered by social media that the media started to report on this. No major conspiracy. But it looked like that to many people who were suspicious anyway.
If phase two was a correction, phase three, panic, triggered an overcorrection, Niggemeier says.
Every tiny story got reported because they didn't want to be shown to cover it up.
But it went further than that. Last spring, German news chiefs gathered in Berlin to reconsider a guideline that is absolutely central to the way reporters cover crime in Germany, a guideline that's been in place for more than four decades.
Guideline 12.1, reports on crimes.
This is Edda Eich from the Press Council, the print media's self-governing body. She agreed to read to me from the Code of Ethics.
When reporting crimes, it is not permissible to refer to the subject's religious, ethnic, or other minority membership unless this information can be justified as being relevant to the reader's understanding of the incident. It must be borne in mind that such references should stir up prejudices against minorities.
So, what does that mean?
Think before you write an article. Think about the relevant information and the effects of your report.
The point is to protect minorities from being stigmatized. But what we have unfortunately found is that the way the media is trying to achieve this goal is actually accomplishing the opposite.
Uwe Wetterich is the editor-in-chief of the biggest newspaper in Dresden, Sächsische Zeitung, or the Saxon newspaper. He's also one of the voices saying that ethical guideline 12.1 needs to be reconsidered.
Of course, most crimes are committed by Germans, but the fact that this is not reported means many of our readers make the false assumption that these minorities are committing the crimes.
While we're talking, he gets up and goes rummaging for some papers.
So, jetzt haben wir, jetzt kann ich hier einmal nachgucken. Also.
It's a study completed earlier this year by a local university in cooperation with the newspaper. They did a telephone survey of 300 newspaper subscribers, asking their attitudes about migrants, crime, and the credibility of the press. And their answers are full of contradictions. One example, more than half of respondents said foreigners are no more likely to commit crimes than ordinary Germans. But when researchers posed a different question and asked them to specifically guess what portion of crimes are committed by refugees,
in almost all categories of crimes, with the exception of murder, the role of refugees is way overestimated.
The survey also asked newspaper readers whether they believe the news they read. And again, deep contradictions. Most people said the paper reports fairly on refugees. But when the question was specifically whether the newspaper conceals crimes committed by foreigners, one in four said yes. And almost as many said they weren't sure.
So basically half of our readers believe we are hiding something from them. Or they're not sure whether we might be hiding something. That's not good. Actually, it alarms us. Because credibility is our highest value. Our business only works because people believe what we write. And if people don't believe us on key points, then we have to ask ourselves how to reclaim credibility.
So, two problems. Newspaper subscribers, who should be the best informed people in the city, have a pretty distorted view of foreigners' role in committing crime. And on top of that, they often don't believe the news they read anyway. Stefan Niggemeier, the media critic, pointed out a third problem. In the old pre-internet days, the biggest daily newspapers pretty much had a monopoly on facts. If they chose not to report the nationality of a suspect...
10 years ago, probably most people wouldn't have heard about a story. It doesn't work anymore. The whole gatekeeper thing doesn't work.
All of this has brought newspaper editor Uwe Wetterich to a radical conclusion.
We want to always give the nationality of criminals and criminal suspects, regardless of whether it's a German, which it usually is, or a refugee or foreigner, which is the exception. And we hope this will create more transparency, to clear up the fact that a crime people have heard about wasn't committed by a refugee, which is typically the case. And if it is a refugee, then we'll say so.
So now, when a guy beats up his girlfriend on a Saturday night, the paper will say a 33-year-old German national was arrested for assault. And maybe, maybe, readers get a clearer picture of crime in their city. It might not be the right approach for everyone, Wetterich says, but here in Dresden, with regular Monday night anti-immigrant demos like the one I attended, here, it's important to try to reconnect people with the facts.
And if we figure out in a few years that it's not working, we'll have to think it over again.
All through our conversation, Wetterich is precise. He's composed. When he really wants to make a point, his voice drops to a whisper. And then this thing happens that takes our conversation in a completely unexpected direction. The phone rings. And when he comes back to the table, Wetterich says it was his wife. And he mentions that she's a West Berliner by birth. Wetterich is from the East. And as a consequence of our different Cold War upbringings, he says, we both love America, the country that let my wife grow up in freedom.
And my life subject is freedom. When I was growing up as a teenager in East Germany, freedom was my great longing.
In Germany, especially in the East, you can take the measure of anyone's life by learning how old they were in November 1989 when the Berlin Wall came down. Uwe Wetterich was 20. He told me his social status was in the toilet. He just finished mandatory service in the East German Army in a unit for Christians and other misfits, guys who refused to pick up a gun and shoot at other Germans trying to escape the country. Wetterich thought maybe he could become a minister, a low-prestige job. And then the wall came down, and overnight everything changed. East Germany announced its first and only free elections, and Wetterich and some friends decided to start a newspaper, really more of a single-issue information sheet, so people could learn about the different political parties they were going to see on the ballot.
We sold them in front of the supermarkets, and there were long lines to get it. Then for me, it was over. The election came, and we were done.
Not long after that, the doorbell rang.
Federic was living in his parents' house in one of those big, ugly high-rises that Eastern Europe is famous for.
It was these guys from the West, and they were holding our newspapers. And my byline was there. And they said, "Is this you?" And I said, "Yes." They said, "Could we talk?"
He invited the editors inside, into his childhood bedroom.
It was tiny, and they sat on the edge of my bed, and they said, "Would you like to start working for us?"
The offer was a paid internship at this paper in a small city in the West. Federic thought it over and said yes. They put him up in a hotel. He'd never stayed in a hotel before.
The next morning, I showed up for work. They took time explaining stuff to me. In the evening, I went home to the hotel, and I knew, this is the job I always wanted. This is actually my dream.
Until he was 20, Uwe Vedrick had no future. And today, he has very little patience for nostalgia. But a certain nostalgia is in the air.
In East Germany, it was more peaceful. A lot of people think things today are worse than they were back then.
At the Pegida demonstration, people marched through the streets, and this one woman fixed me with a suspicious glance and kind of reeled me in. Doris is retirement age, a seamstress by training. She told me her city has changed a lot for the worse. Migrant militias, drug dealers, murderers roaming the streets.
Three quarters of the refugees are criminals, the young ones anyway. And 8% of them are literate. What are we supposed to do?
Where are you getting your facts, I ask. Doris mentions two fringe websites, Kompakt and Politisch Inkorrekt, which each claim to be against Islam and against mainstream media. I ask Doris whether she reads Uwe Vedrick's paper, the Saxon newspaper. Yes, she says, I subscribe. Reluctantly.
My husband likes to read it, but if it were up to me, I'd have canceled it a long time ago. They're a part of the lying press. A lot of people stop getting the Saxon newspaper because they're against us. And they hardly ever report the truth.
After we part ways, a shout goes up through the crowd. Merkel, that's Chancellor Angela Merkel, has to go. Uwe Vedrick told me when these demonstrations started, he was completely caught off guard.
And then, after maybe 3 or 4 weeks, it was clear to us that this was an unbelievably a dynamic movement, and the movement directed at us, which was something new.
Us, the establishment press in general, and this newspaper in particular. And at this point, Uwe Vedrick switched very briefly to English.
On a lot of Mondays, for nearly 30 minutes, you hear a chorus of Lügenpresse, Lügenpresse, or Schämt euch, schämt euch, lying press and shame on you.
And Uwe Vedrick, the editor-in-chief who almost became a minister, he's trying to figure out how to talk to people who seem to be speaking a completely different language.
Turn on your brain. Why do you think people want to come here? How come no one from here wants to go live in their countries? Because this is the great system you're living in. It draws people from around the world. Of course, every system can be abused. There is a migration crisis. I'd agree with the Pegida people on that point. No question. I say, let's write about it. And I'm confident it'll change.
In March, the Press Council voted to keep Section 12.1 of the Ethics Code. It was a unanimous decision. In July, the Saxon newspaper officially broke with that guideline. The editors explained the paper will always report the national identity if that information is available. Quote, not giving the nationality of criminals and criminal suspects can create room for rumors, which often harm the people we wish to protect.
Ilya Meretz is a reporter for WNYC. Now, there's a twist to this tale. As he mentioned, this rule discouraging the media from using the race and ethnicity of a person in a story is decades old. But Ilya, hello.
Hey.
What prompted this rule?
This story is so weird and surprising, especially to me, a guy who has lived in Germany a bunch and known a lot of Germans. Most of the quirks of German life seem to be explained around the year 1945, end of World War II. And I just assumed that this guideline dated back to that time. No, it dates back to the early 1970s, and it has everything to do with America, oddly enough.
Huh.
Yeah.
Why?
So I got this story from Maria Höhn. She is now a history professor at Vassar, but in the late 60s and early 70s, she was a teenager living in West Germany in a little village on the edge of a huge U.S. base. And what she told me is she remembers so clearly seeing this change in the Black American servicemen. It seemed to happen just overnight.
You know, who were Afro hairdos, who would raise their fist, who had these dab handshakes. We were, of course, totally fascinated by all of this, as you can imagine. But you also saw this incredible tension between white and Black soldiers.
Now, this was when the Vietnam War was on.
Exactly. There was a draft, as you know, and a lot of the conscripts came from the South.
We're talking the Deep South.
Deep South.
White young men from the Deep South.
Correct. And the Army, keep in mind, had actually only been fully integrated like a little over a decade.
You know, white young men who were very unhappy about these African-American GIs who maybe came from Chicago or New York, who they considered to be too cocky or too self-assured, whatever. So there was a lot of fighting between the soldiers.
There was a massive spike in violence involving U.S. military personnel over in Germany. Of course, that caught the attention of the local press.
Soldiers having fights with soldiers.
Fights with soldiers, also in some cases getting involved in altercations with locals. It was a time of so much stress. Of course, German newspapers were going to be covering it. And when a fight broke out, a typical newspaper might report it something like this.
And here's Marie again.
Yeah.
It's just like 10 Americans are fighting and 3 Negro soldiers. That kind of language that right away sets the Black soldiers apart.
The NAACP thought this was important enough that they flew to Germany to do an investigation. And what they found was that Black soldiers had a hard time renting apartments. Many bars were closed to them. And in 1971, an umbrella group of German-American friendship organizations decided that the problem had to do with language. And they petitioned newspapers to leave a soldier's race out of their reporting unless skin color was directly relevant to the crime. Their theory being if you set these Black soldiers apart, it makes people perceive them differently.
But that just applied to soldiers.
Yes, correct. But they went to Germany's press council and said, hey, we have this problem. And the rule that the press council wrote applied to any kind of minority, whether it be gypsies or Roma, homosexuals, whoever. It's been tinkered with over time, but the basic principle was unless the suspect's nationality or race is really important to the crime in some way, it doesn't belong in the article. And what could be more American than that?
Right.
Yeah.
WNYC's Ilya Meritz. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Dasha Litsitsina, who leaves us this week to travel America. Goodbye, Dasha. We'll miss you. And good luck. We had more help from Emma Stelter, Isabel Christo, and Micah Lowinger. And our show was edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Holford. Catcher Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.